Numbers, chapters 7 and 8, the fourth talk in a series on Numbers, was presented by David Crabtree on September 2, 2018, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by David Crabtree and is being made available to you by Gutenberg College. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. Contributions to David Crabtree may be made at www.soundinterp.wordpress.com. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. Handout number 4, numbers 7 and 8, accompanies this talk.
Okay, we're continuing in Numbers. We'll be looking at chapters 7 and 8 today. So we're still on Mount Sinai. We've been there for, it's not clear how long the Israelites have been there. It's probably been a few months, along like 3 or 4 months that they have been at Mount Sinai. They are still there. They are still in the process of getting organized and ready to depart. And in the last few chapters, the first 6 chapters of Numbers, they have had a census of all of the Israelites in order to get themselves organized as a military force. Then there has been a census of the Levites because the Levites are a substitute for the firstborn. There was a counting of the Levites to make sure that there was a Levite for every firstborn. And for every firstborn that didn't have a Levite, a ransom had to be paid. Another census was taken of the Levites as well. And this one was to see how many able-bodied men they had, and then assignments were given to each of them. We've also had the camp organized, and we have gotten ourselves organized for the trip, so we know what order we're going to be proceeding in when we take off. Then last week, there were 2 chapters of laws that were presented. All but one of them were just filling out laws that had already been given in Leviticus. One of them, the law with respect to the Nazarene, that had not been given in Leviticus, and apparently that was a phenomenon, a custom that already existed, and there were some regulations given with respect to that particular practice. And I think that those laws that were in the last 2 chapters are just representative laws indicating 2 things. One is that God's law-giving activity is ongoing, at least at this point. And the other is that a reminder that God is the law-giving God who gave them the laws that are listed in Exodus and in Leviticus. Now, in these 2 chapters, first chapter, it's going to be gifts given to the tabernacle and the Levites. And the second chapter is going to talk about the purification of the Levites. They will be ordained. So chapter 7, the first section, verses 1 through 11. Now it came about on the day that Moses had finished setting up the tabernacle, he anointed it and consecrated it with all its furnishings and the altar and all its utensils. He anointed them and consecrated them also. Then the leaders of Israel, the heads of their fathers' households, made an offering. They were the leaders of the tribes. They were the ones who were over the numbered men. When they brought their offering before the Lord, 6 covered carts and 12 oxen, a cart for every 2 of the leaders, and an ox for each one, then they presented them before the tabernacle. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Accept these things from them, that they may be used in the service of the tent of meeting, and you shall give them to the Levites, to each man according to his service." So Moses took the carts and the oxen and gave them to the Levites. Two carts and four oxen he gave to the sons of Gershon, according to their service, and four carts and eight oxen he gave to the sons of Merari, according to their service, under the direction of Ithamar, the son of Aaron the priest. But he did not give any to the sons of Kohath, because theirs was the service of the holy objects, which they carried on the shoulder. And the leaders offered the dedication offering for the altar when it was anointed. So the leaders offered their offering before the altar. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Let them present their offering, one leader each day, for the dedication of the altar." It starts out in verse 1 saying, "And now it came about on the day that Moses had finished setting up the tabernacle." The day that the tabernacle was set up happened a little while ago. So this goes back to the end of the book of Exodus. And there are some people who think that all of this that's talked about in chapter 7 and chapter 8 is events that happened right after the setting up of the tabernacle and the anointing of it. And therefore, it precedes what was talked about earlier in Numbers. So some people think that it's not in chronological order. This is going back before. It's possible. It's hard to tell, but I don't think that that's probably the case. It doesn't need to be the case. It is just talking about an event that occurred earlier to remind us of that thing that happened earlier, because it's significant for what it goes on to talk about. That was the anointing of the tabernacle, and these are gifts for the tabernacle and the Levites. It seems to me more likely that these chapters are indeed in chronological order. It's after verse 1, which is just putting it into context. Here's the way that Kyle of Kyle and Delitzsch puts it together. I'll read one paragraph. "There was an interval of at the most 40 days between the anointing of the tabernacle, which commenced after the first day of the first month, and lasted 8 days, and the departure from Sinai on the 20th day of the second month. And from this, we have to deduct 6 days for the Passover, which took place before their departure. And it was within this period that the laws and the ordinances from Leviticus 11 to Numbers 6 had to be published, and the dedicatory offerings to be presented. Now, as the presentation itself was distributed, according to verses 11 and following, over 12 or 13 days, we may very well assume that it did not entirely precede the publication of the laws referred to, but was carried on in part contemporaneously with it. The presentation of the dedicatory gifts of the one tribe prince might possibly occupy only a few hours of the day appointed for the purpose, and the rest of the day, therefore, might very conveniently be made use of by Moses for publishing the laws. In this case, the short space of a month and a few days would be amply sufficient for everything that took place." So that's the way he's putting it together, and I think this is likely. We know that we have 40 days maximum between the time when the temple is anointed and they take off from Mount Sinai. So we just have 40 days there. And a lot of things have to fit into those 40 days. The first is the temple has to be, Yes, there is an 8-day period during which the temple is being consecrated and the priests are being consecrated. And then we have to have the publication of the laws that are talked about in Leviticus and at the end of and in Exodus. So all of Exodus, all of whatever's talked about in Exodus needs to fit in that time slot. There's not much action in Exodus, in Leviticus. It's mostly laws. But that has to fit into that time period right after the temple is anointed. And we've got these presentations of offerings, which are going to take, there's one each day for every tribe. It's going to take 12 days. And then we have 6 days of Passover before they take off. So what Kyle is suggesting is that the presentations that take 12 days and the publication of the laws of Exodus probably coincide. And if they coincide, then we can fit all of this stuff into 40 days easily. So that's what he's suggesting, and that seems like a reasonable solution to me. Okay, so the leader of each of the tribes brought a gift to the tabernacle. These are gifts for the Levites, it says specifically. And in most significantly, these are the leaders. It's the leaders who were in charge of the census that it talks about in chapters 1 and 2. These are the same ones who bring these gifts to the Levites. Each leader brings one ox. We have 12 tribes, so there are 12 oxen. Every two leaders brings a wagon, so there are 6 wagons that are brought. And these are probably, my Bible translates it carts, but they're probably four-wheeled wagons. These are wagons that are used for carrying freight. They're covered and four wheels. And then these wagons and these oxen are given to the Levites, and then they are going to be used for transporting the tabernacle. So one tribe, Gershon, gets 2 wagons, and the tribe of Gershon, the family of Gershon, it's a subset of the Levites, they are responsible for conveying all of the fabric, the curtains, the veils, all that sort of thing. And they've got 2 wagons for that purpose. 4 are given to the family Merari, and they're the ones that are responsible for carrying all of the pillars and all of the panels that are inside of the tabernacle. So they've got a lot of heavy stuff that they have to carry. No wagons are given to Kohath because the tribe of Kohath carries the furniture and they are supposed to carry that on their shoulders. So they don't get any wagons. Each of these then brings their gifts and presents them before the altar. Milgram says that this is an initiation. Initiation is offering is given with these gifts rather than a dedication offering. I don't know why he makes that distinction, but he seems to think that that's important. Maybe we'll find out later. I think it's important to note at this point that if you recall back to Exodus, so just a few weeks earlier, they had given a lot of gifts in order for there to be the materials from which the tabernacle could be built. And the text stressed how much they had given, how generously they had given. So an awful lot of their wealth has been transferred from their pockets into the tabernacle and into the pockets of the Levites. And I think that's worthy of note. The next section, starting with verse 12, I'm going to preface it. This is a very repetitive and a long passage because the same thing is repeated almost word for word 12 times. Ashley, one of my commentators, says, "This passage is one of the most repetitive and consequently one of the most ignored passages in the Old Testament." And he is the one who also pointed out that Numbers is one of the most neglected Bible books of the Bible. So we're looking at one of the most neglected passages in one of the most neglected books of the Old Testament. But this passage is not spellbinding, but I think that one needs to recognize that there's something going on here, that there's a genre that's happening here, and we got a hint of this in Exodus, where God gave the instructions to Moses as to how to build the tabernacle, and then a few chapters later we see how it was built, and it uses a lot of the exact same wording to show that they had done everything that God had told them to do. It's quite repetitive on the one hand, but on the other hand, it makes a very important point, and that is they did what they were told to do, all of it. And so the repetition is worth making that point. I think that's the way they saw it. In this case, the impression that's created, if you allow yourself to think about it this way, is the impression that's created is there is a real pageant going before us, right before our eyes. There's this parade of things that are going right in front of us. And it's the same thing over and over and over again, but it's kind of like a military parade. In a military parade, there aren't big surprises, but you show row after row of soldiers marching just to show how much force there is, how much power there is. That's the point of a military parade. And in this case, it is to show how much they gave to the Levites and to the temple. And I think it's trying to underscore that point, and therefore creating this, in words, creating this pageant that passes before our eyes. Okay, and I'm going to read it. Starting with verse 12. Now the one who presented his offering on the first day was Nashon, the son of Naminadab, of the tribe of Judah. And his offering was one silver dish, whose weight was 130 shekels, one silver bowl of 70 shekels, according to the shekel of the sanctuary, both of them full of fine flour mixed with oil for a grain offering, one gold pan of 10 shekels full of incense, one bull, one ram, one male lamb for 1 year old for a burnt offering, one male goat for a sin offering, and for the sacrifice of peace offerings, two oxen, five rams, five male goats, five male lambs 1 year old. This was the offering of Nashon, the son of Amminadab. On the second day, Nethanel, the son of Zuar, the leader of Issachar, presented an offering. He presented as his offering one silver dish whose weight was 130 shekels, one silver bowl of 70 shekels according to the shekel of the sanctuary, both of them full of fine flour mixed with oil for a grain offering, one gold pan of 10 shekels full of incense, one bull, one ram, one male lamb, 1 year old for a burnt offering, one male goat for a sin offering, and for the sacrifice of peace offerings, two oxen, five rams, five male goats, five lambs, 1 year old. This was the offering of Nethanel, the son of Zuar. On the third day, it was Eliab, the son of Helon, leader of the sons of Zebulun. His offering was one silver dish whose weight was 130 shekels, one silver bowl of 70 shekels, according to the shekel of the sanctuary, both of them full of fine flour mixed with oil for a grain offering, one gold pan of 10 shekels full of incense, one young bull, one ram, one male lamb, 1 year old, for a burnt offering, one male goat for a sin offering, and for the sacrifice of peace offerings, two oxen, five rams, five male goats, five male lambs, 1 year old. This was the offering of Eliab, the son of Helon. On the fourth day, it was Elizur, the son of Sedur, king of the sons of Reuben. His offering was one silver dish whose weight was 130 shekels, one silver bowl of 70 shekels, according to the shekel of the sanctuary, both of them full of fine flour mixed with oil for a grain offering, one gold pan of 10 shekels full of incense, one bull, one ram, one male lamb 1 year old for a burnt offering, one male goat for a sin offering, and for the sacrifice of peace offerings, two oxen, five rams, five male goats, five male lambs 1 year old. This was the offering of Eleazar the son of Sedeur. On the fifth day, it was Shelumiel the son of Zurishaddai, leader of the children of Simeon. His offering was one silver dish whose weight was 130 shekels, one silver bowl of 70 shekels, according to the shekel of the sanctuary, both of them full of fine flour mixed with oil for a grain offering, one gold pan of 10 shekels full of incense, one bull, one ram, one male lamb 1 year old for a burnt offering, one male goat for a sin offering, and for the sacrifice of peace offerings, two oxen, five rams, five male goats, five male lambs 1 year old. This was the offering of Shelumiel, the son of Zurishaddai. On the sixth day, it was Eliasaph, the son of Deuel, leader of the sons of Gad. His offering was one silver dish whose weight was 130 shekels, one silver bowl of 70 shekels, according to the shekel of the sanctuary, both of them full of fine flour mixed with oil for a grain offering, one gold pan of 10 shekels full of incense, one bull, one ram, one male 1 year old for a burnt offering, one male goat for a sin offering, and for the sacrifice of peace offerings, two oxen, five rams, five male goats, five male lambs 1 year old. This was the offering of Eliasaph, the son of Deuel. On the seventh day, it was Elishama, the son of Amihud, leader of the sons of Ephraim. His offering was one silver dish whose weight was 130 shekels, one silver bowl of 70 shekels, according to the shekel of the sanctuary, both of them full of fine flour mixed with oil for a grain offering, one gold pan of 10 shekels full of incense, one bull, one ram, one male lamb 1 year old for a burnt offering, one male goat for a sin offering, and for the sacrifice of peace offerings, two oxen, five rams, five male goats, five male lambs 1 year old. This was the offering of Elishama, the son of Amihud. On the eighth day, it was Gamaliel, the son of Pedazur, the leader of the sons of Manasseh. His offering was one silver dish whose weight was 130 shekels, one silver bowl of 70 shekels, according to the shekel of the sanctuary, both of them full of the fine flour mixed with oil for a grain offering, one gold pan of 10 shekels full of incense, one bull, one ram, one male lamb 1 year old for a burnt offering, one male goat for a sin offering, and for the sacrifice of peace offerings, two oxen, five rams, five male goats, five male lambs 1 year old. This was the offering of Gamaliel, the son of Pedazur. On the ninth day, it was Abadan, the son of Gideoni, leader of the sons of Benjamin. His offering was one silver dish whose weight was 130 shekels, one silver bowl of 70 shekels, according to the shekel of the sanctuary, both of them full of fine flour mixed with oil for a grain offering, one gold pan of 10 shekels full of incense, one bull, one ram, one male lamb 1 year old for a burnt offering, one male goat for a sin offering, and for the sacrifice of peace offerings, two oxen, five rams, five male goats, five male lambs 1 year old. This was the offering of Abadan, the son of Gideoni. On the tenth day, it was Ahiezer, the son of Amishaddai, leader of the sons of Dan. His offering was one silver dish whose weight was 130 shekels, one silver bowl of 70 shekels according to the shekel of the sanctuary, both of them full of fine flour mixed with oil for a grain offering, one gold pan of 10 shekels full of incense, one bull, one ram, one male lamb 1 year old for a burnt offering, one male goat for a sin offering, and for the sacrifice of peace offerings, two oxen, five rams, five male goats, five male lambs 1 year old. This was the offering of Ahiezer, the son of Amishadai. On the 11th day, it was Pagiel, the son of Achran, leader of the sons of Asher. His offering was one silver dish whose weight was 130 shekels, one silver bowl of 70 shekels according to the shekel of the sanctuary, both of them full of fine flour mixed with oil for a grain offering, one gold pan of 10 shekels full of incense, one bull, one ram, one male lamb 1 year old for a burnt offering, one male goat for a sin offering, and for the sacrifice of peace offerings, two oxen, five rams, five male goats, five male lambs 1 year old. This was the offering of Pagiel, the son of Achran. On the 12th day, it was Ahira, the son of Enan, leader of the sons of Naphtali. His offering was one silver dish whose weight was 130 shekels, one silver bowl of 70 shekels, according to the shekel of the sanctuary, both of them full of fine flour mixed with oil for a grain offering, one gold pan of 10 shekels full of incense, one bull, one ram, one male lamb 1 year old for a burnt offering, one male goat for a sin offering, and for the sacrifice of peace offerings, two oxen, five rams, five male goats, five male lambs 1 year old. This was the offering of Ahira, the son of Enan. So that's our 12-day parade. Each day it's the same thing, just offered by a different tribe. And just notice that each one is bringing three utensils, three dishes and bowls, two of them made out of silver, one made out of gold. The two out of silver are full of flour and oil. The one made out of gold is full of incense. So all of these are going to be used as offering material. Then it's a bunch of animals. And I don't know the language of the sacrifices yet. I'm waiting until I do Leviticus to figure all of that stuff out. But we have three animals that are brought as a burnt offering, and then a goat that's brought for a sin offering. And then for a peace offering, there are a whole bunch of animals. It's, 17 animals that are sacrificed as peace offerings. And Milgram suggests that these sacrifices were probably made on the day that the animals were brought. So each day, these animals would have been sacrificed. Okay, and then just the wording for these is almost identical for each day, but there are a few places where the wording isn't identical. One of the really strange ones, and one that I cannot account for, is that on every day it says that the person who brings it is the leader of their tribe. The only day where that does not happen is on the first day. It just says that he is of the tribe of Judah. A very curious omission, and I don't know how to account for it. Another thing that is also curious is if these happen 12 days in a row, one of these days was a Sabbath. And it's probably the seventh day, but there is no mention of the Sabbath, and the offering happens even though it's the Sabbath. So the Sabbath doesn't preclude this thing from happening, which is curious. Okay, the next section is a summation of all those things that were given. And we'll read through that. Verse 84. This was the dedication offering for the altar from the leaders of Israel when it was anointed. 12 silver dishes, 12 silver bowls, 12 gold pans, each silver dish weighing 130 shekels, and each bowl 70. All the silver of the utensils was 2,400 shekels according to the shekel of the sanctuary. The 12 gold pans full of incense weighing 10 shekels apiece according to the shekel of the sanctuary, all the gold of the pans 120 shekels. All the oxen for the burnt offering 12 bulls, all the rams, 12, all the male lambs, 1 year old, with their grain offering, 12, and the male goats for the sin offering, 12, and all the oxen for the sacrifice of the peace offerings, 24 bulls, all the rams, 60, the male goats, 60, the male lambs, 1 year old, 60. This was the dedication offering for the altar after it was anointed. So I think that the emphasis throughout here is, look at all this stuff that was brought to the temple, brought to the tabernacle, and given over to the Levites. There's a lot of stuff and a lot of wealth. Remember when we were talking about redeeming the firstborn, that it was 5 shekels per firstborn. And that was, wasn't that a half a year's salary? It's a lot. It's a lot of money. Then just the last verse telling us about the completion of these gifts. 89. Now when Moses went into the tent of meeting to speak with him. Oh, I'm sorry. This is starting the next section. We'll just start the next section. Now when Moses went into the tent of meeting to speak with him, he heard the voice speaking to him from above the mercy seat that was on the Ark of the Testimony, from between the two cherubim. So he spoke to him. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to Aaron and say to him, when you mount the lamps, the 7 lamps will give light in the front of the lampstand. Aaron therefore did so. He mounted its lamps at the front of the lampstand, just as the Lord had commanded Moses. Now this was the workmanship of the lampstand, hammered work of gold, from its base to its flower. It was hammered work, according to the pattern which the Lord had showed to Moses. So he made the lampstand. This is a little bit curious. It makes a certain amount of sense. The tabernacle has been anointed. It has been consecrated. Apparently the gifts have been given. And now God speaks to Moses and says, it's time to light the lamps of the menorah inside of the tabernacle. And it is interesting now that God is going to speak to Moses inside the tabernacle rather than outside the tabernacle. There are a few things that are worthy of note here with respect to lighting the menorah inside of the tabernacle. One is that it is Aaron that actually does the lighting. He's representing the priesthood, and he's the one who lights the lamps on the menorah. The second is that he was told specifically to direct the light forward, and that is said 2 times. So that seems to be an emphasis here. For some reason, the light needs to be directed forward. And this is in the holy place, and I'll talk about this a little bit more, the two things that are right in front of the menorah are the table of showbread and the altar of incense. Then it recounts how the menorah was supposed to be made. And it points out that it was made just the way that God had commanded it to be made. It's made from 1 piece of gold. So it's a unity. It's not a bunch of parts. I should point out, the lamps themselves go on the lampstand, so they are separate. So there are 7 lamps that go on the lampstand, but the lampstand itself is all 1 piece. And it was hammered from 1 piece of gold. So it's not poured, it's forged, which I think is an interesting fact. Okay, so what's the point of this passage? What's going on? It's clearly symbolic, and the question is, what does that symbolism indicate? Ashley says, every commentator has a different suggestion for what's going on here, what this means. Ashley says, the whole menorah might be said to symbolize God's perfect presence and light, illuminating his sanctuary, and through Moses, his people. I think this is clearly symbolic. The question is, how do you interpret these symbols? What all of these things, and I'll talk about this more next week, but all this stuff, the sacrifices, the tabernacle, It's all just full of symbols, but the question is, how do you interpret them? What content do you give to these symbols? And one of the most difficult issues is, whenever we see the menorah, does it symbolize one and the same thing? And is that a specific thing? Or does it symbolize a complex of things, associated meanings, a whole complex of associated meanings, that sometimes in the context, the one aspect of that symbolism is being drawn upon, and another place, another aspect of that symbolism is being drawn upon? Or can these symbols have different meanings depending on the context or the religious rite or whatever's going on? And I don't know the answer to those questions. But I think that in order to make sense of these, we have to envision exactly what's going on. And so let me fill out the scene as best I can, so that you can envision what this actually looks like. And then I'll give my best guess as to what's going on in this particular situation. So this is in the inside the tabernacle, inside the tent. And if I am standing inside the tent, if I'm standing facing, let's see, I got to get this right. If I'm standing facing west, then in front of me is the Holy of Holies, and behind me is the entrance to the holy place. And the Ark of the Covenant would be in the Holy of Holies. On my right would be the menorah. On the left would be the altar of incense and the table of showbread. The floor is sand. It's just the sand that's there. Above me, there is a piece of cloth that goes over the top that has woven into it special designs that are similar to the ones that are on the veil that separates this from the holy place. Behind me is the door to the holy place, and there is also a veil, and it has special designs on it. There is no light that's going to come in from above or from any side. The only place any light might come in would be through the entranceway. There's cloth there, but I don't know how sheer that is. I don't know if that is light-proof or whether it allows some light to get in. And there might be some light that would come around the edges, I don't know. Maybe underneath, just daylight that would come in. Any light that does come in, however, if you will remember, the wall on the north side and the wall on the south side, those are both covered with gold. So any light that does come in is going to get reflected around. So what Aaron is told to do is to light each of these lamps and put those on the lampstand. And so you've got seven lamps that are up on the lampstand that are sending light. And I don't know, I have seen the lamps. I've seen lamps that were typical back in ancient times in Israel. And I don't know how the light would be directed forward. There must be some way that you could direct that light more one direction than another direction. But I don't know how that is, because the way they're shaped, it's not easy to envision how that would happen. But in any case, the light needs to be focused forward. That's said two times. That seems to be important. So once those lamps are lit, then, with the gold wall on the north and the south, that's going to be reflected. So it'll get quite light with seven lamps in it and that reflection happening. Okay. This is just, at this point, I'm just playing with what some of these things could symbolize. I don't know if this is right or not. The priests seem to represent those people who embody God's presence in this world. In other words, God's people. The table of showbread, as best I understand it at this point, represents God's provision for man. The continuous provision that God makes for man. And the altar of incense seems to represent the prayers of men. What God has, what people have to say to God and the requests that they make of God. So if what Aaron is told to do is to light these lamps and direct them on those two objects, and that seems to be what he's told to do, then what he's being told to do, what's the symbolism behind this is God's people then illuminate or testify to the truth that God is the source of all provision for man and God is responsive to man's needs. So that's my best guess as to what is the symbolism that lies behind this act of lighting this lamp. If that's the case, then these generous gifts that were just given are thoroughly justified. This is a very beneficent God that we're dealing with, who provides for his people and is responsive to their needs. But that is all subject to revision as time goes on, as I learn more. Okay, the next section then is the ceremony in which the Levites are dedicated to their office. Starting in verse 5. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Take the Levites from among the sons of Israel and cleanse them, and thus you shall do to them for their cleansing. Sprinkle purifying water on them and let them use a razor over their whole body and wash their clothes, and they shall be clean. Then let them take a bowl with its grain offering, fine flour mixed with oil, and a second bowl for you shall take for a sin offering. You shall present the Levites before the tent of meeting. You shall also assemble the whole congregation of the sons of Israel and present the Levites before the Lord. And the sons of Israel shall lay their hands on the Levites. Aaron then shall present the Levites before the Lord as a wave offering from the sons of Israel, that they may qualify to perform the service of the Lord. Now the Levites shall lay their hands on the heads of the bulls, then offer the one for a sin offering and the other for a burnt offering to the Lord, to make atonement for the Levites. And you shall have the Levites stand before Aaron and before his sons so as to present them as a wave offering to the Lord." Okay. There is the ceremony that is used to ordain the priests is presented in Leviticus chapter 8, and you can compare them. It is a much more detailed, the ceremony has a lot more details in it. There are more sacrifices that are made, but there are a lot of elements that are the same. The same elements are, one, they start out by gathering all of the necessary offerings and people. Two, they go to the tabernacle. Third, they gather the Israelites as a whole, the assembly of all of the people. Fourth, then they wash the priests and the clothes. Fifth, there is a sin offering. And sixth, there is a burnt offering. But there are some differences that stand out. One is, when the priests were consecrated, Moses alone conducted the ceremony. In this consecration of the Levites, Aaron plays a role in it. Secondly, the priests were anointed with oil. The Levites are not anointed with oil. Third, the Levites shaved their bodies. The priests did not. And I'll just point out, I'll talk about this later, but the only other time that you have people shaving their bodies before a ceremony at the tabernacle is lepers who have been cleansed of their leprosy before they before their ceremony continues. They have to shave their bodies in front of the tabernacle. Fourth, the elders lay their hands on the Levites. That does not happen with the priests. It is typical for hands to be laid on any animal sacrifice that's given. And that happens in this one as well. But first, the elders of Israel, it says the people of Israel, but it's probably the elders of Israel, lay their hands on the Levites. And then lastly, it says that the Levites were offered as a wave offering. And that's the only time that that is said of people. Verses 14 through 19. Thus you shall separate the Levites from among the sons of Israel, and the Levites shall be mine. Then after that, the Levites may go in to serve the tent of meeting. But you shall cleanse them and present them as a wave offering, for they are wholly given to me from among the sons of Israel. I have taken them for myself instead of every first issue of the womb, the firstborn of all the sons of Israel. For every firstborn among the sons of Israel is mine, among the men and among the animals. On the day that I struck down all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, I sanctified them for myself. But I have taken the Levites instead of every firstborn among the sons of Israel. And I have given the Levites as a gift to Aaron and to his sons from among the sons of Israel to perform the service of the sons of Israel at the tent of meeting and to make atonement on behalf of the sons of Israel, that there may be no plague among the sons of Israel by their coming near to the sanctuary. So this is giving the reason, that kind of an explanation for who the Levites are and why they are have been set aside. They are a group of people that have been taken out of the rest of the Israelites, and they are designated specifically for the service of God and his tabernacle and for to serve Aaron also. And God has taken the Levites in place of the firstborn of Israel. We've seen that repeated several times in Numbers already, that theme has come up. And it points out that God has a right to the firstborn because he could have killed them, along with all the rest of the firstborn in Egypt. But he didn't. He spared them because of the blood on the lintels. And that seems to be the emphasis of this passage, is that's why the Levites exist, and that's their role. The next two verses just stress the completion of this activity that they have been given to do. Thus did Moses and Aaron and all the congregation of the sons of Israel to the Levites, according to all that the Lord had commanded Moses concerning the Levites, so the sons of Israel did to them. The Levites too purified themselves from sin and washed their clothes, and Aaron presented them as a wave offering before the Lord. Aaron also made atonement for them to cleanse them. Then, after that, the Levites went in to perform their service in the tent of meeting before Aaron and before his sons, just as the Lord had commanded Moses concerning the Levites, so they did to them. Then the last section, I don't know how to explain why it's here, why this is in the book of Numbers, but I'll read it, verse 23. Now the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, this is what applies to the Levites. From 25 years old and upward, they shall enter to perform service in the work of the tent of meeting. But at the age of 50 years, they shall retire from service in the work and not work anymore. They may, however, assist their brothers in the tent of meeting to keep an obligation, but they themselves shall do no work. Thus you shall deal with the Levites concerning their obligations. So it's talking about Levi retirement plan. And it says that they are to retire. They're supposed to work from the age of 25 until 50 years, and then they are to retire. Now, there a lot of what they do is manual labor. It would be hard work. As we get a temple, one of their main jobs is to cut firewood and haul that up to the temple and make that available for the offerings, and to haul water up to the temple mount so that that's available, etc. So they've got manual labor that they're involved in. Why it's from 25 years old up to 50 here, I don't know, because the census earlier of the Levites was from 30 years to 50. And here an extra 5 years has been tacked on. Just as a kind of an interesting little side note, in 1 Chronicles 23:24, David lowered the age of service for Levites from 30 to 20 because the temple required more workers. This was just before the temple was built, and David lowered the age at which Levites would begin working to 20 so that they would have more Levites to do the manual labor. So it is not unprecedented that those ages would be changed, but why it would be changed from just a few weeks earlier to this, I don't know. It is interesting that at the age of 50, they retire, but they can continue to work. They just are not responsible for the work getting done. So it's the younger ones are responsible to make sure that it gets done, but the older ones are allowed to continue to work. And I think that's interesting. But why this section would be here in Numbers, I do not have a good reason for it. And not a single commentator that I read gave any suggestion as to why they thought this might be here. Okay. I said at the beginning that when I first started in Numbers, that one of the things that we needed to be on the lookout for was trying to figure out who are these Levites and what are they doing here. They play a relatively prominent role in the first 10 chapters of Numbers. One thing that we see pretty clearly, I think, is that the Levites are less holy than the priests are. The word that is used when the priests are consecrated is that they are sanctified. Kadosh is the word. That's the word that's used in talking to about the priests. But in talking about the Levites, they're purified rather than sanctified. Ashley says, the most obvious point of contrast visible in several separate matters is that while the Levites are brought into the sphere of the ritually clean, the priests are brought into the sphere of the holy. Thus, while the Levites are purified, the priests are sanctified. So we have a clear hierarchy of holiness that's being represented in this camp of Israelites. The most holy is the high priest. So Aaron represents that which is most holy. Next, then, is the priests. So his sons and their sons. Third is the Levites. And that's reflected in the organization of the camp. They're the ones just outside of the sanctuary. Next, then, are the lay Israelites who surround, then, the Levites in the camp. And lastly are the unclean Israelites. They're the ones who have to stay outside of the camp. So there's a clear hierarchy of holiness, and in that hierarchy of holiness, the priests are more holy than the Levites. There are a few features in the Levite consecration ceremony that are important. One is, I think they're important. I don't know what to make of them, but I think they're important. The first is, there is a sense in which they are treated like they have a heightened degree of uncleanness. They have to shave themselves in front of the tabernacle before the rite can proceed. And as I mentioned before, that's just like lepers who have been cured of leprosy. That's got to be significant. Second thing is they're treated like an animal sacrifice in certain respects. Milgram says Kippur means atonement or covering. Kippur is a function of the Levites, as a function of the Levites, is clarified by the context of their purification ritual. After they are purified, they undergo two cultic rites. The Israelites lean their hands upon the Levites' heads, and Aaron dedicates them to the Lord by means of the elevation ceremony, that is the wave offering. These two rites are everywhere else reserved for animal offerings and are never used with humans. As I mentioned before, placing the hands on the animal that is to be sacrificed, that is standard procedure. That's done almost always. And they're supposed to really put their weight on it, which I think is interesting. And the other they are offered as a wave offering, and that's not otherwise done with people. But they are not like animal sacrifices in that they are not put to death. Rather, apparently, they live as servants to the priests and God, and as a result, they appear to be living sacrifices of some sort. And it can be said of both priests and Levites that they make atonement for the people. However, the priests make atonement for the people by sacrificing animals. The Levites make atonement for the people by being the sacrifice. Milgram says, thus the Levites, unlike the priests, do not perform Kippur. Rather, Kippur is performed with them. So this creates kind of a puzzle. How do we put these pieces together? And I do not have a good answer for this one. Milgram has an odd solution for this, the way he puts this all together. Milgram thinks that the Levites become the guardians of the tabernacle, and if they allow anyone who should not approach the tabernacle do so, they take the penalty for the encroachment on themselves, that is, they die, and thereby save the nation as a whole from judgment. Here are his words. Therefore, the probability is that all texts that construe Kippur with Ketzef Negev have Kofar in mind, innocent life ransomed by the guilty parties or their representatives. And our text, 8:19, would then imply that the Levites are a ransom for Israel, a lightning rod to attract God's wrath upon themselves whenever an Israelite has encroached upon the sancta. So he thinks that Levites then, if anyone who shouldn't come near the tabernacle does so, they allow it to happen, then they take the wrath of God on them instead of all of the people. He thinks that's the sense in which the Levites are an atonement, a Kippur for the people. I think that's unlikely. It seems to me that doesn't account for all of the details. But I don't know how to put this together. It's a puzzle. I'm convinced that it's significant. I'm convinced that the Levites are significant, especially with respect to Numbers. There's been a lot of ink with respect to the Levites in Numbers so far. I'm also convinced that the details of the rites all have symbolic significance. They tell some kind of story, but I don't know what that story is, so it's a puzzle that we can all work on. My hope is that as we proceed through Numbers, it might become clearer exactly what role the Levites play and what is the story that this the rite of the Levites tells us. Okay, any questions or comments?
As time went on, and I know during the Babylonian captivity, things got a little mixed up and people kind of, in a sense, forgot where they came from, tribe-wise.
Some did.
Mm-hmm. But the priests, were they still Levites when they were the Sadducees were the high priests, right? In Jesus' time?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So were they Levites?
The word Levite is used in two different ways. One is from the tribe of Levi.
Right.
Yes, in that sense, they are Levites.
Okay.
But the term Levite also then becomes used in other places. It's used for these who are non-priests, those Levites that are not descended from Aaron.
Oh, okay.
So that's a more technical sense in which the right. term is used.
But and that they're descended from Levi, though, which was one
are,
of the tribes.
They are descended from Levi, yes.
Okay, so are the Sadducees that are the priests in Jesus' time, were they descendants of Aaron as well? Did they come from that family line?
I'm not positive. Yeah. Because when the Seleucids take over, people become high priest by paying the biggest bribe.
Okay.
And I'm not positive that it was always someone from the priestly line that got the position.
Okay. So we don't really know when Aaron's line of priests kind of quit being the high priest.
It depends who the we is. If it includes me, no.
the general scholar.
I'm not sure. I don't know if anybody else knows.
No, but history doesn't really say at this point in time Aaron's descendants quit being the high priest.
Well, I know it gets dicey when the Seleucids move in.
Yeah. Two questions, please. Are there any analogous implements or rituals among the local pagan tribes or religions that might illuminate some what was going on in the tabernacle?
Yes. And I haven't looked into that. My son tells me that he sent me a book on Hittite, the Hittite priesthood, which I have not yet read. And he tells me I need to, but that could be helpful. And what I'm expecting to happen is, like with the tabernacle itself, as has been pointed out by other scholars in great detail, the tabernacle resembles a phenomenon in Egyptian culture. But there is one major difference is that the Egyptian army, when it was on an expedition, the Pharaoh sat on his throne in the equivalent of the Holy of Holies. That was his throne. And with the Israelites, there's nobody sitting on that. That's God's throne. And he is not represented by any image. So it's those kinds of differences that are really significant, I think.
I have actually found the similarities reassuring because it tells me that whoever wrote this was not making up something completely new. This was not alien. Therefore, it's rooted in the time and the culture that
exactly.
it says it is.
Exactly.
And I like that.
Yeah.
The other question, the observation.
Let me comment. Joshua Berman wrote a three-part article that was published in Mosaic online. in which he goes through and talks about the similarities between the tabernacle and the Egyptian practice and the little hut that they had for Pharaoh. And he points out that it was only in a couple hundred years that this was true of the Egyptian army. And that couple hundred years corresponds with the time of that the Exodus was to happen. So he makes that very point. He says, this must reflect intimate knowledge of the time in order to be described the way it is.
When they talk about these ox carts, mm-hmm. and I envision the Oregon Trail, you know, you take off from Missouri and you've got this boat with wheels and mm-hmm. If you're driving an ox cart, you're using roads. I mean, the paths they trod, they traveled, had to have been actual trade routes. They had to have been the same routes that the armies used when they headed north. They couldn't have been going over, you know, eastern Oregon in these ox carts and survived. I mean, they would have fallen apart. So do we need to adjust our image of the Exodus as to be more like our vision of the wagon trains, or the caravan routes, mm-hmm. Rather than just beelining across the wilderness and getting lost.
I used to think that it was just like walking on the beach. There's just sand and flat and maybe rolling or whatever, but no real obstacles. And there probably were areas where that was the case. I haven't been to the Sinai, but my understanding, especially when they get down to Mount Sinai, it's very rugged territory. And we'll see there's a passage coming up in Numbers that I think is really curious. And I think it has to do with Jethro's son wants to go back home. And Moses says, no, please stay on. We need someone to show us the route, show us the way. There are two things that I find interesting about that. One is we have the cloud and the pillar of fire. Why do they need somebody to show them the way? My guess is that the cloud and the pillar of fire are not specific enough to tell them where you put your foot the next step. So they need to find their way to get to the cloud and the pillar as it moves. The other thing I find interesting about that is that they need a scout. They need somebody who knows the way. And so there are parts of it that are rugged, I think, and parts of it that are difficult. And one issue, obviously, is going to be water. Where do you find water? Where do you find a place to camp? Where those kinds of issues?
Where do you find wood to build wagons? I mean, where do you find food to feed an ox?
Right.
Are they buying this along the way
tribes? Yeah, I think they are. I think they have been. All along the way, we do know that there were trade routes that went from Egypt to Mount Sinai, because Mount Sinai was an area in which there was quite a bit of mining being done by the Egyptians. So, but they were typically only used at a certain time of the year. It was too hot in the summer, and I can't remember all the other factors, but it's only used for a few months out of the year that people actually go back and forth on that. But they apparently were trading with people along the way. I don't know how much they brought out of Egypt with them. Some of those carts could have been carts that they brought out of Egypt. I don't know. But they do seem to be trading with people along the way also. The hides that covered the tabernacle, they now think are dolphin skins. Now, where'd they get the dolphin skins? Well, in all likelihood, they got them from going along the Red Sea. If you look at the one boundary on the Sinai Peninsula is the Red Sea. And there are abundant dolphins there and porpoises. And so either they caught them, which is a possibility, or they're trading with people who caught them. So there must be that kind of activity going on, I think.
But there were 22,000 Levites or something. How are you envisioning, was this a group cleansing and dedication? They didn't do that one at a time, did they? Or?
Well, I am dubious of the large numbers
right.
throughout here. And that extends the 24, 22,000 extends. I'm dubious of that number also.
Okay.
But in any case, it's a fairly large group, and I don't know exactly how they're doing it, but they're all gathering in front of the tabernacle, having a group shaving party and all the other stuff. There are a lot of animals being sacrificed that would feed quite a few people, so it's probably quite a few people that we're dealing with, but I don't think
so. Do you think the animals being sacrificed is per capita, per individual Levite, or?
No.
It's for the whole group
of Levites, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then the other one is, it is striking, and correct me if I'm wrong, but some of the tribes were, according to the numbers again, were twice as big as others.
Right.
But their offering is equal.
Right.
It's the same.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. That's true.
No justice there.
Yeah. Yeah.
When you talk about levels of holiness, high priests, Levites, and the common Israelites, are you talking about that in the sense of their duties with regards to the tabernacle, or in another sense? I mean, how do you determine if one person is more holy than another person?
We'll talk about that next week.
Oh, okay.
I just got to figure out what I'm going to say. But yeah, let me figure out what I'm going to say.
Okay.
Any questions I can't answer? That'll be tough. Okay. Thanks.